Fork Tales, a podcast that feeds ideas to the food and beverage world. Fork Tales is brought to you by Vigor, a branding and advertising agency focused on the restaurant and hospitality industry, and by Quench, a food and beverage advertising agency that specializes in evolving iconic food and beverage brands. Learn more, visit vigorbranding.com and quenchagency.com. If you love what we're serving up, please give Fork Tales a 5-star review on your podcast service of choice. Think of it as a tip for good service.
Hi, today on Fork Tales, we are joined by Curtis Chin. Curtis is a writer, a filmmaker, an activist, and an author of the memoir, Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant. The book reflects on his experiences growing up gay and Chinese American in 1980s in Detroit and working in his family's landmark restaurant. Curtis, thank you so much for joining us.
Excited to be here.
Yeah, it's great. Like on Fork Tales, we talk about like CPG, food and beverage. We talk about restaurant groups and architects, all that stuff. And so I'm excited about this because this is sort of a different angle for us. I mean, you know, obviously it's about restaurants, but we're not going to be sitting here talking about like, I don't think family recipes. So you said that you know, we as people are a reflection of the places we grew up in. All right. So you grew up in Chung's Cantonese cuisine in 1980s in Detroit. So you grew up in your family's restaurant. You know, how did both of those environments, the restaurant and the city, shape you today?
Well, I grew up in the restaurant, but I was one of those kids that didn't know how to cook. So I was banished to the dining room. So that's where I actually did most of my learning. And it's about all the people I met there. I like to say that even though I don't work in a Chinese restaurant anymore, I'm still that Chinese waiter. Mm-hmm. In the sense that I go around asking people, what can I get you? How can I help you? And so I think that's been a good philosophy throughout life. You know, why not spend a little time and just make someone have a nicer day?
Yeah. It doesn't hurt. You know, I mean, I think a lot of people, I'll say of a certain age anyway, probably all started somehow in a restaurant. Now, you had your family's restaurant. Obviously an ethnic, I mean, you know, it was a cultural thing, which was phenomenal. But I'll say for myself personally, like I my first job was washing dishes in a restaurant. Then I wanted to make it to the front lines and, you know, wear clean clothes, right? And so I was able to work as a busboy in the front of the restaurant. It was kind of a white tablecloth restaurant. So I learned about taking care of people, being polite to people, serving people, being accommodating, being respectful. I learned a little bit about mixed drinks because I was in the back of the talking to the owner and the bartender. And I learned a lot about food, learned how to eat. Like, I mean, watching people with different I mean, it's kind of a wow. So you do get this incredible education that you don't even know you're getting, right?
Yeah, you learn about people. I mean, so our restaurant was located in Detroit, in the inner city, in the red light district, the bad part of Detroit.
Yeah.
If you can understand, that's actually the bad part about Detroit. But, you know, like the city, it was like divided. So like during the day, we'd have all these white collar professionals who came from downtown or came from the medical center. But in the evening, we'd get the local, you know, pimps, prostitutes, drug dealers. So I got a really front row vantage to see the whole city, everybody from the mayor, right, to Oscar-winning actors that would come in, you know, to the Jewish family that came every Sunday. It's like, you know, you really, really got to see the whole city of Detroit, you know. And the idea of serving people and working in food service, I mean, that's just, I feel like it's just the greatest upbringing. I mean, because it really teaches you how to be, a better person, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, speaking of your upbringing, I mean, you always said that, you know, your parents told you to talk to strangers. I mean, that's usually the opposite of what people say. So what did those dining room conversations teach you?
Yeah, you know, my dad always gave us that advice, talk to strangers, because he's a guy that grew up in Chinatown, never left, never went off to college. He didn't necessarily know what opportunities existed outside of the four walls of that Chinese restaurant, but he knew that he had this dining room full of people who did. And so anytime he met somebody who he felt like had a cool story or just seemed really happy, he'd call all six of us kids to run over and barrage them with questions of, what do you do for a living? How did you get your job? How much money do you make? And it's just these ideas of not being afraid of talking to people who are different from you, not being afraid of asking questions when you don't know the answer. And most importantly, not being afraid of asking for help when you need it. because my dad was just so open and just so, you know, about connecting. And I think that he wanted us to really take advantage of you know, the people that were coming into our restaurant.
Yeah. I mean, it's great. It's actually really great advice, especially, you know, your father did that way back when to teach you to talk to people, to learn it. But now it's like almost like fast forward to now, like a lot of young folks are like texting and everything else. Like I find it interesting to see how difficult it is for young people to communicate and to talk to people and to go up and ask questions and just, you know what I mean? They're so used to hiding behind the camera or, I mean, the screen or the phone. So.
Yeah. So for me, going out to eat is really not just about great food, but also about great service. Obviously something that's a controversial, but I'm going to say it anyway, is that I would much rather go to a restaurant with mediocre food and great service, great food and mediocre service. Because for me, it is so much about like that interaction with the people there. And it kind of makes me a little sad that sometimes I'll go to these restaurants out here in LA where you're ordering, you know, off your phone and the QR code, right, and the little robot that brings the food to you. And you have so minimal interaction with the wait staff. They don't even know your name. And, you know, I'm of that age where I just, you know, love that idea of going into your regular place to eat and having them say, hey, how's it going? And,
yeah,
you know, chatting up with them.
That's awesome.
Stuff, but we see that less and less these days. And I think that's something we need to get back to, right?
Yeah. So you'd mentioned, I read somewhere that your restaurant in Detroit at that time was almost sort of like I'm using the term melting pot, but I think it's like a safe haven. And so talk about some of the people, because you hit on it in the beginning of the conversation about, you know, you had white collar workers in the day and maybe pimps and prostitutes at night. So it was very eclectic. Talk about the mix of people and like maybe what that mix of people taught you.
Yeah. So in my book, that's a big part about my book is like all these different, you know, characters that would come in, like Yul Brynner, the Oscar-winning actor, came in one day. I'm trying to figure out how long of a story to share with you because it's in the book. But it's just, he taught me about the value of treating people nice because he came in and he was like this big Hollywood actor and he just wasn't necessarily the kindest, you know, people. My dad, who's like this Chinese waiter, you know, is busting his butt trying to make sure these celebrities are having a great time. And I just realized, well, if I'm going to look up to somebody, it's going to be my dad and not this Hollywood star. Or, you know, the drag queens that would come in, you know, how they were a bit sassy and what that taught me about like fighting back, you know, and standing up for yourself. Or the mayor who came in and talked to me about being angry and how you can use anger as a motivating force. The mayor being Coleman Young, who was like this, you know, the first black mayor of Detroit, how he was really combative and, you know, how he used that to his advantage, which is something I'd never thought of because my family's Buddhist, were thought to be kind and combative and be angry. And so it just, you know, meeting all these people, they just give you a different perspective, a different way to sort of see the world. And I just never thought about that as a little kid that I was giving this great education just by hearing how other people operate in the world, which makes you maybe hopefully a little bit more empathetic.
Yeah. Well, before I forget, let's talk about the name of the book, just in case folks want to pick it up. Because it is great. It's great. The information in.
Yeah. It's called Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant. It was published by Little Brown. It came out about a year and a half ago now. It's gotten great press. The New York Times did a 2-page profile, Washington Post, LA Times, Boston Globe, CBS Saturday Morning News did an 8-minute segment. It's just been incredible. It's already in its third printing. The state of Michigan picked it as the Great Michigan Read. So it's just been just a really wonderful experience to sort of be able to share my family stories with everybody.
Very cool. That's very cool. Congratulations. So, okay, obviously you're a writer, filmmaker, an activist. You know, a lot of folks that come on this podcast, they're in the family business. They're in the restaurants. It was, they started with one, now they've got 30, or they started with one and they had an idea and they created a whole franchise. So did you feel a lot of pressure to stay in the family business?
Oh, I wish my dad were like that. It would be great if like 30 or 40, you know, in a franchise or whatever. And you know what? So let me tell you a little bit about the restaurant. It was actually founded by my great grandfather in 1940. Wow. So it was a legendary Chinese restaurant in Detroit. And when I do these presentations, I've done about 300 in-person talks around the world, right? In 7 countries, you know, for the book. And I usually start off by asking people to guess how many egg rolls you think we sold in the 65 years that we own this business. Take a guess.
Me?
Yeah. How many egg rolls do you think we sold?
Well, if it's a Chinese restaurant, I would think an awful lot. I have no idea. I'd say over a million.
We sold over 10 million egg rolls.
Wow.
And these were all handmade by my grandmother and my mom and my aunties, right? Like even the skin and the sauce. So it was a legendary egg roll. And we closed the restaurant 20 years ago, but I still get requests from it. And in fact, I was just back in Detroit because I've been promoting the book a lot back there. So many people come up and they're trying to revive the Chinatown in Detroit because it's sort of like much of the city, it sort of disappeared in the 80s and 90s, but they're trying to revive it. And one of the things they've been trying to do is to get my family to reopen the restaurant. Wow. And so, I don't know, we're talking to my siblings about possibly doing a pop-up next time. I already know. I feel like if I sold egg rolls and included a free copy of my book, I'd probably sell more books.
Another angle could be a lot of companies, a lot of folks we work with, they'll have a restaurant. And it could be just one restaurant like yours.
Yes.
But they're really known for something phenomenal, like your egg rolls. And they end up going the CPG route where they end up like making these egg rolls fresh or whatever, partially baked or cooked. And then they freeze them and becomes, that's a very interesting, especially I'm sure there's still a lot of halo from your brand and your family's restaurant that would follow that product, you know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, if anybody's interested in reaching out to me, I'd be happy to talk to them. But back in the day, we actually were approached by the airlines, you know, I think they were looking more at our cookies because my grandmother also made the cookies because they're pretty famous for that as well. But, I'm open to these things. I mean, you know, I grew up in that restaurant. Whether or not I would have continued and taken over the family business, I always loved being there, but I also loved writing. And so I wanted to pursue that career. Now that I've had some success and, I've gotten that out of my system, I just finished another film for PBS. I've had a really, really great run. I sometimes think like, well, is there a way to sort of like reconnect with that Chinese restaurant past and bring that back into my life? Mm-hmm. So I don't really know. I'm open to it. And that brings up the question, can you ever go back? Right.
That's right. Well, it's cool because you talk a lot about that, the restaurant, the impact. So, I mean, in your book, it talks a lot about growing up Chinese American and gay in Detroit during the 80s and a very tumultuous time in Detroit. How did food help you navigate your cultural identity growing up?
Yeah, I mean, Detroit in the 80s was really rough. I mean, you had the auto industry that was really, taking a lot of shots. You had crack cocaine. You had AIDS. Mm-hmm. I knew 5 people murdered by the time I was 18 years old. But despite that, I feel like I had the greatest childhood because of this wonderful Chinese restaurant where my parents were able to raise me and my 5 siblings. And we didn't have a lot of money. I mean, it was tough. I mean, with such a big family and Detroit going through such hardships. But the one thing that my family always made sure we had enough of was food, right? They never denied us anything.
Yeah.
With that said, eat whatever you want on the menu. sometimes my siblings and I would like to eat the lobster, which my grandmother pissed off. She's like, you can't eat it. That's the profit. Come on. But my parents are so generous. They'd be like, no, we'll just do it behind grandma's back. And she won't get mad at us. So food and that idea of cultural identity, because my family's been in this country since the 1800s, I don't have a lot of ways to feel connected. Like I don't speak the language. I don't speak Chinese. I don't have family members in China. I don't have a sense of, what's going on there. But I think the one connection that I did keep, or the one primarily, was food, right? I mean, that's the thing that's the easiest for people to hold on to, like in terms of, their ancestors and where they're from. And, obviously when you're in a restaurant, you're seeing it, literally 24/7 or whatever.
Yeah. That's very, very, very interesting. So you think, it's kind of interesting too. I mean, like the whole ethnic thing with restaurants and like, my wife is Greek. So she grew up with restaurants and first generation and just, and food is love. Like, right. So I think for a lot of immigrants, when they came, it's like, they started out, they started with nothing. They worked really hard, probably like your grandmother. Right. And food was really the priority at the end of the day. Like you want to make sure the kids were fed and the family was fed. Money. Yeah. We need money. Sure. But food, So it's kind of funny how you say that, like, your parents always eat what you want, have what you want. I mean, it's a,
Well, you know, in a lot of Asian cultures, you don't greet people by saying hi. You greet them by saying, have you eaten yet?
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And so I think that actually does say something about it. But in terms of the idea of Greek diners, Detroit has a lot of them.
Oh,
and
sure.
I've been approached by so many, you know, people, not just Greek, but also Polish or Mexican, who say like that restaurant experience is the exact same one that I had. You know, I mean, we didn't serve Chinese food. We served tacos, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's this idea of this family working yep. hard, sacrificing, that tight bond, maybe knowing a little too much about each other, but, you know, in each other's face. But yeah, I mean, if your wife, you know, you said your wife actually grew up in a restaurant, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, her father had several and yeah, it was always working. Mother and father were working in the restaurants all day long. So in the restaurants. You know, yeah, a big part of their life. Big part of their life.
Have her read my book. I'm sure she'll feel like,
yeah.
I totally relate to that.
Yeah.
Stuff. Like, you know, it's the craziness. But
that's awesome. So we're going to talk about a little bit more about Detroit as a backdrop. You now live in Los Angeles, right? So do you visit Detroit often? Do you still have family there? What's your connect ties?
Thanks to the book, I mean, it's been really embraced by the home state. I think I mentioned earlier that it got picked by the state for this thing called the Great Michigan Read.
Mm-hmm.
One book every 2 years and buy 6,000 copies. And they put me on a tour of the state. So I've been going back a lot because of that. But also, like, you know, entities like the Detroit Pistons and the Detroit Lions have brought me back to give talks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the state library, it's like, you know, Ford Motor Company. So because my memoir isn't just about the restaurant and it
sure.
isn't just about my family. It's about my city of Detroit because mm-hmm. growing up, you know, the city took a lot of knocks, right? And I just felt like I wanted to write the story of Detroit that's realistic. Yes, a lot of bad things happened during that time period, but also a lot of good things happened too. And I wanted to show that balance. And one of the greatest things is I've been having all these Detroiters, not just people who still lived in Detroit and continue to fight for Detroit, but the people that left who say, thank you for, you know, talking about Detroit and showing a different side of the city that people don't necessarily hear. And I think that's partly why the book has been so embraced by the state, you know, because I'm telling that side of the Michigan story that maybe people might not be familiar with. Detroit is a character in my book, definitely.
Yeah, that's awesome. So how did the racial tensions affect your family's restaurant and in your personal story? I read where, you know, like you said, it was sort of like your restaurant was like a safe haven in the middle of maybe some chaos.
I mean, the Detroit and the racial tension definitely impacted my life. In fact, I talk about, like, you know, there's this famous thing called the Detroit riots, or what they call mm-hmm. the rebellion, right? You know, when the National Guard got called in
sure.
Because of the civil unrest that was happening in the 60s. And so basically, when the tanks rolled into Detroit, they shut down the city for 5 straight days. And if you're a Chinese restaurant, you don't close for 5 straight days. You're always open. But in that time period, my parents actually found time to have sex. And so 9 months later, I was born to a riot baby. And so there's a direct correlation
between
racial tension in Detroit and my birth. Because yeah. without that, I probably wouldn't be around. And so that's why.
Riots are in your DNA.
It's in my DNA. It's what it kind of is, right? Detroit is a divided city.
Yeah. Right?
And you're talking about black and white or rich and poor.
Right.
Jewish, Christian, whatever. Like, there's this famous street there called 8 Mile Road, which really divides the city. And when you've had to navigate that your whole life, you understand that, you know, life is this balancing act of trying to bring two sides together. And being not black and being not white, you know, I got to see both sides of the argument, you know, between mm-hmm. the two different sides and trying to figure out, well, how do you bring these two sides together? One of the reasons I wrote this book is because I just felt like this country is very divided right now. We have these little silos where we don't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. But Chinese restaurants are actually one of the few places where you can go in and see someone from a different race or mm-hmm. class, you know. And maybe if you just leaned over and asked the person next to you, like, what are you eating? And you just have these little conversations that maybe this is how our country heals ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe just, I know it sounds stupid, but, like, you know, maybe even just this idea of making small talk over food is a way of getting us to get along with each other. And so, you know, I said to my agent, I was like, I'm pitching the book as come for the egg rolls, but stay for the talk on racism. So, you know, these are very important issues and I don't want us to skirt them, but we've got to be able to talk about it in yeah. a way that actually brings us together and makes us feel like we understand each other a little bit better. And I yeah. think that that's one of the advantages of being Asian American, because we're not of the dominant white community. We're also not, you know, Black. We don't have either experiences. We can see both sides in some ways. So maybe we can use that.
It's really interesting. And, you know, you're really making me think about, a lot about this because, well, you know, do you think restaurant, like, so do you think restaurants in like a working class city, like, serve a different role than those in the wealthier places? Like, you know, if you're, you're in LA now, right? So you go downtown LA, all these great restaurants and all that. But like, compare that to say your parents' restaurant in Detroit and where it was located. I mean, they really, I mean, yeah, they sell food, but they really do serve almost two different needs, don't they?
Oh, yeah, no, totally. Especially when you're looking at a city like Detroit, which throughout my childhood was literally burning down, right? Literally burning down every building, every, you know, it was devil's night. It was just all this craziness in the city. And, you know, I actually, when I'm a first generation college kid, right? Which means that, you know, I went off to Michigan, Ann Arbor, and leaving my parents behind at the restaurant was really traumatic in some ways. I used to have all these nightmares that my parents would get, you know, murdered, you know, at work, you know. And I always knew that my parents were sacrificing and putting themselves in harm to create a better life for me and my siblings, right? But what I didn't realize that my parents were also creating a better life for the people of Detroit, because so many of the businesses were closing. So many of the favorite restaurants were like shutting its door. And my parents worked really, really hard to create that space where Detroiters could come in and feel like they had a nice, safe meal. And I think that's just something we don't think about, the way these small, you know, family restaurants really do. They're the glue to a lot of communities, right?
Yeah, and
the
there's no question.
Yeah, those people that are behind them are as much community organizers and as much as like civic leaders as politicians or activists or whatnot, because they're actually doing the hard work of getting people to come together.
You know? Yeah, I mean, I can I can completely relate in two different scenarios. One, my brother-in-law, Greek, has a restaurant in a town, and it truly is the community center. It truly, it's the same people like kind of joking with each other on the same nights that come for the same food or the same lunch. I mean, it's just an ongoing, it's a community center, and it's pretty phenomenal because of that. You know, it's pretty special. And to the point of what I'll say, these smaller restaurants in these communities serve. I mean, it really does serve. That's a meeting place for these folks.
Yeah. And these days people eat by themselves a lot more. They're getting DoorDash at home. They're not seeing other people. But you know what? You got to go out to a restaurant. You got to sit in and eavesdrop on the table next to you. You got to see the people coming in to see what's going on in your local community. Yeah. And that's how you feel connected to people. But I feel like, again, we're creating these little silos. And, you know, and they even talk about this, like, you know, because my other career is writing and film and TV. It's like, you know, in the old days when I was a kid, you'd watch TV together as a family, right? Mm-hmm. Now you just watch on your own little screen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and we need to find these spaces where we're actually interacting with each other more, because I think that's what will heal this country, right? Like finding these moments where we're actually engaging with each other. And I don't know how to do that, but I think restaurants are part of that solution.
I think you're right. You know, you bring up a really interesting point, because I was thinking about the other example I have is there's this place in the middle of nowhere, and it's a little mountain town. There's probably about 10 to 12 homes on the main street. There is only one street, and there's a little restaurant there, and it's like Norman Rockwell. It's like jumping back in time. And I love it because the people know me, and I feel like, you know, and I travel like you. I travel the country. I've eaten at the nicest restaurants and all that. This is just simple, as basic as it can get. But you know, as I think about it, it's really a lot of older people, even in my brother-in-law's restaurant. So to your point, I mean, I hope that is part of the future. I hope that is a part of bringing people together and not, you know, I hope we're not heading into a different, a DoorDash siloed, watching one screen lifestyle, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Chinese restaurants are going to save America.
I love it. I love it. I love it. All right. So your book's laid out like a restaurant menu. You have appetizers, soup, specials, desserts. Talk about the format, and what's your favorite course or chapter of your book?
Well, you know, I wanted to have fun with this book, right? So in addition to laying it out like a menu, the opening line is "Welcome to Chung's," you know, is for here to go. So that's what my dad would say to anybody that came in. And that's sort of the theme of the book, for here to go. Do I stay in Detroit or do I leave? You know, so I brought in that metaphor. And the last line in the book is, thank you, come again. Right? Because mm-hmm. I really want the reader to read the book as if it's they're going into a Chinese restaurant and having mm-hmm. a meal. And so that's why some of the stories are sweet, some are savory, some are salty, some are spicy. You get all these different flavors. And so I feel like that's also part of a Chinese restaurant experience, right? The diversity of the things that you can order. And so I just wanted to have fun with it. I mean, the book is, there are 24 chapters. There are three sections, right? 8 stories in elementary, middle school, 8 in high school, and then 8 in college. And 888 is good luck to Chinese people. So all these little fun little things I try to do secretly that is like, oh, if you know, you know. You know.
Well, one of our offices, you know, in Philadelphia is, you know, it's the Pavone Group, and we're right in Chinatown. We're like a half a block away. So it's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. One of the things I did out of 300 tours that I did was I actually did about 30 Chinese restaurants where mm-hmm. I would go in, and instead of talking about my book, I actually interviewed the owners of restaurant and found out their stories and, you know, what their favorite dishes are and what they're going through, because, you know, so many of these Chinese restaurants are having a difficult time, you know, post COVID. Mm-hmm. I mean, all restaurants are having difficulties, but I think maybe the aspect of, you know, there's a little bit of COVID-ness, anti-Chinese, anti-Asian. And you know, a lot of these restaurants really do operate right on the margins, right? Mm-hmm. They don't have much fat, literally, you know, in terms of losing a few customers here and there. And I think that's in some ways has made a negative difference, unfortunately. And so that's why so many of them are struggling.
That's sad to hear. I guess I won't say it makes sense. I kind of forgot about that, you know, that's a shame. But, and you know, Chinese restaurants are woven into nearly, you know, every American town and city. So why do you think Chinese restaurants have such a unique place in American culture?
Well, I think that, so I'm actually doing a lot of research on the history of Chinese restaurants. It's actually quite fascinating because Chinese restaurants were really the first restaurants that a lot of people went out to eat, right? Because mm-hmm. as soon as Americans started getting disposable income or they had to start go out to eat, you're not going to go and eat at the restaurants that your mom or your dad can make the food, right? You're going to go to the most exotic place. Mm-hmm. So from that origins, that's why Chinese restaurants really took off. And I think the thing is Chinese restaurants are very, very adaptable, right? Even just the way you cook the dishes. And so I think that ability of do custom order helped them. But they've been very innovative. And I think that the way we as Americans eat food have really been shaped by Chinese restaurants. I mean, think about takeout delivery, right? Chinese restaurants,
That's right?
Open concept kitchens, right? Where you get to see what people are cooking. Mm-hmm. Chinese restaurants, because they used to say that we cooked rats and dogs. So we had this whole kitchen. You know what I mean? Like, even the stupid little menus that are slipped underneath your door, like, you know, custom ordering your dishes. All these things are pioneered by Chinese restaurants, right? So if you really take a step back and think about it, how do we as Americans eat our food? So much of it is, was shaped by these things. And obviously now the ingredients, the diversity and all that's, you know, actually having a more direct, you know, thing. I mean, you know, there are 40,000 Chinese restaurants. They say more Chinese restaurants than McDonald's, Burger King, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell combined. You know what I mean? They really are everywhere. If you do the research and you find out like what is the most Googled type of food, you know, it's Chinese food, right? Like all the ordings, everything. I mean, yeah, we don't think about how ubiquitous it is, but Chinese food is really, really everywhere. I mean,
what kind of misconceptions about the food, about the Chinese restaurants are you hoping to dispel?
I think one of the challenges that I would like to see happen with Chinese food is that, you know, people think of Chinese food as being cheap. Mm-hmm. And I have no problem with Chinese food being affordable because I think that's good and that's what makes it accessible. And I wouldn't want Chinese food to be thought of as high-end and inaccessible to people. But I think that we have to appreciate a little bit more, partly because I think of the families that are running these Chinese restaurants. And like in the case of my family, over the summers, we worked 80 hours a week. It's really hard because the profit margins are so slim that it's a volume business. You just, you make so little off of each dish that you just have to sell a lot of food. Mm-hmm. But if there's a way that you can just increase the price point just a little bit, maybe an extra 50 cents, an extra dollar, that would make such a big difference to that family and allow them, you know, to have a break, right? To like be able to take a vacation, be able to not struggle so hard. And so I'd like to see us start thinking of Chinese food as not as a cheap meal, but as an affordable meal.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm glad that it's still, you know, broadly available to any class of people. Mm-hmm. I would never want that to change, but we've got to find a way that so that the families are not struggling so hard, you know, to maintain these businesses.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny too, because we're located. It used to be easy to find good Chinese food. Mm. And I'm in central Pennsylvania now. Like when I'm in Chinatown in Philly, I have no problem. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a mecca, right? But here, I mean, we really can't get good Chinese food. And it's really candidly quite a shame.
Are you by college?
We're not.
No, because probably, that's one of the interesting things too, is that you can find good Chinese food in a wider space, because before you'd have to go to the big city, mm-hmm. like New York or San Francisco, mm-hmm. to find it. But because of the explosion of Chinese students on college campuses, international students, mm-hmm. You know, there are really, really good Chinese restaurants on every college town throughout. And that also has increased the appreciation of Chinese food around. I don't know how that's going to change. They've said that because the current government is clamping down on international students, that's had a trickle-down effect where a lot of these Chinese-American businesses are now suffering because those clients, those customers are no longer coming to the schools. And so that's something we have to think about too.
So we talked about your book, and it's quite entertaining and interesting. What else do you have planned? What else are you working on? What else can you let us in on?
Well, I just finished another film for PBS about this wonderful artist named Warren King. He has a really fascinating background. His dad, they're from Taiwan. His family's an engineer. His dad was an engineer. Forced his son to go to MIT and then Stanford engineering. And then work in the family business. Warren hated his life, kept fighting with his dad. When his wife got a job working in Sweden, he took it as an opportunity to reinvent himself. And he just looked around the apartment and saw these cardboard boxes and started making these fantastic pieces. So if your listeners want to just Google the name Warren King, you know, look up his stuff. You'll be amazed. They're like these modern day terracotta warriors made from Amazon boxes. It's just incredible. You know, and so that's going to, you know, I'm doing that for, I just finished that film for PBS. But the other thing that's more Chinese, well, I'm doing a memoir, the second part to my memoir, which is called Leftovers.
Of course.
You know, sadly, so the setting of that is in 2005, I was writing for the Disney Channel. And sadly, my parents were in a car accident, and my dad passed away, and my mom was severely injured. My brother Chris, who's a doctor in California, immediately whisks my mom out there to help her recuperate. By the end of that first week, all my other siblings decided they were also going to leave, you know, and join my mom out in the Bay Area to help her recuperate. And I was left behind in Detroit trying to decide, do I go back to Hollywood or do I stay and take over the family business? And so that book is called Leftovers. And so, you know, I'm working on that. And then finally, I want to do this Chinese restaurant project because, you know, as I mentioned before, I've done over 300 readings in 7 countries, right? Including some cool places like Oxford University and the British Library and the largest U.S. military base in Asia, in Korea. Wow. It's crazy how this book has traveled. But at all these places, I've met these people will come up to me and say like, oh, I'm a Chinese restaurant kid too. Your experiences in your book are just like mine, even though I grew up in Mauritius or Suriname or Belgium.
It's crazy.
And so I'm going to put together this website where people can share their own family stories and their photos and, you know, ideally, we'll get some really, really great stories and some interesting recipes and things like that. And I'll put together a coffee table book, amongst these stories. I think that'll be a really fun project, too. So
that's fantastic. Yeah, that's very cool. And congratulations on everything you're doing. I mean, film, writing, I mean, it all. It's just really terrific. So what was your favorite in your parents' restaurant? What was your favorite meal?
Yeah, that's really hard to say, right? It depends what day. I mean, like, I eat a lot of noodles because I'm superstitious and noodles are good luck. I love the beef and mushroom dish that we made. But the one dish that I always cite is a Detroit original called Almond Boneless Chicken.
Okay.
And I actually was approached by America's Test Kitchen, the show on PBS, to produce, you know, an episode of their podcast looking at the origins of that dish, because it's a dish that my grandmother claims to have invented. Uh-huh. And they were like, prove it. show us that your family actually invented it. And so basically it's a fillet of white chicken meat, mm-hmm. breaded and then deep fried and then placed over a bed of iceberg lettuce. And then ladled with this really nice brown gravy and then sprinkled with crushed almonds and pea pods and water chestnut and mushrooms. And it's just, it's a Detroit thing. All the restaurants in Detroit, maybe not more recent, not the newer ones, but the old school Cantonese ones, they all had it. And so I did the research and found out the history. And there's a really, really interesting history based off of what you talked about earlier, which is the racial dynamics of the mm-hmm. city, is because almond boneless chicken is basically Southern fried chicken, right? With the Asian gravy on it.
Yeah.
And because Detroit has a lot of Southerners, that's, so it's based, it's a traditional Chinese dish called wasio op, almond pressed duck, right? Because, but in America, we don't eat as much duck as other places, right?
Right.
You know, and, but we do eat chicken. And, you know, Chinese people generally prefer dark meat over white meat. Mm-hmm. So it's really a nod to like the Southern roots of Detroit, you know, mixed with the Asian culture. And so I love looking at things like that and sort of how you can understand your own history and your city's history and your family's history all by looking at the things on your menu. So I always say like, that's a dish I always tell people about, the almond boneless chicken.
That's fantastic. I mean, like how many people have a dish that their family made famous? I mean, that's really, really, really cool.
Well, I couldn't prove it.
Yeah. Say, hey, look.
Our menu's going all the way back to the 1930s, right? Yeah. So it appeared on our family's menus as early as that. But to actually say that we were the only ones to have it then, I don't know. But I could prove that where it took off at other Chinese restaurants was in the 60s, mm-hmm. right? And again, that was the civil rights movement. And that's mm-hmm. when communities were being shifted around in Detroit. You know, the Chinatown was destroyed and the black neighborhood of Black Broadham was destroyed. And so that was the first time that those two communities, you know, had to live next to each other because they all moved to the Cass Corridor. And that's when the dish really exploded, you know, was when the African-American community discovered the dish.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me, like, when you say about like the culture or the location, how it maybe affected it pushes the product and changes it, and you know you grow from it. A good friend of mine has a restaurant, several restaurants in Chicago, and he also has a pizza company. And it was really interesting because, you know, if I ask you what do you think the number one topping on pizza is, you know, you'd probably say pepperoni, right? So, but in Chicago, the number one topping on pizza is sausage. And it goes back to his grandfather, because he had a little tavern where he was making pizzas in Chicago, but it was surrounded by a German neighborhood, and they liked sausage. And all he wanted to do was sell these guys beer and, you know, give them something. The sausage, and that became like a Chicago thing. A Chicago pizza has sausage. So anyway, just really interesting things how ethnicities and different locations kind of mash up, you know. And in marketing, go ahead.
I was going to say, the beauty of that story that you just shared is it you know, food allows you to reach out to somebody else and say, I see you.
Right.
We know you. I see what you're interested in, right? And that connection is appreciated from that other person on that other side, right? Yeah, it's a very nice story.
Yeah, it's kind of neat how it all works. He also told me that they have the round pizzas, but they cut them in little squares. And the reason they would cut the pizza instead of like in the pie shape, the reason they cut the squares is it fit on a number 9 napkin in the restaurant. So, when, you know, and they put extra salt on it so they would drink more beer.
Oh,
the profit. The profit margin was in the beer, so they just give them the free pizza slice on a napkin to get them to drink more beer. Anyway,
claim that they also invented the process of cutting them in squares. Is he claiming?
That's where it started in the tavern. So, because it fit on in this number 9 napkin. Now, it might be like your grandmother's story. Maybe we can't prove it out, but it's a fantastic story, and it actually makes a lot of sense. You know,
it's a Chicago thing.
Yeah.
Because Detroit does that too, right? Mm-hmm. And we get a lot of our cooking influence from the city of Chicago.
Sure.
Because it's the Midwest capital, right?
Yeah,
and
so right.
A lot of people end up in Chicago first and then migrate out to the smaller cities like Detroit or Milwaukee or whatever. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. There's that connection.
That's awesome. So now I have to ask you one last question. You kind of answered it on your family restaurant, but I want you to do, you're allowed to broaden your palate here. What is your last meal? What are you going to eat, where and why? If you had one meal to pick.
Oh, that's I'm very superstitious and we don't talk about last meals. That's not, but if you asked me, if you went to a Vegas buffet, what was the first thing you would grab? I always go to the prime rib station. Sorry.
There you go. No, that's all good. Prime rib. I respect that.
Yeah. But God, I just love food. I mean, but I always say, like, you know, if I had a choice in life, I would live above a Chinese restaurant overlooking a canal. I don't know why it's not. I just love it. But yeah, food is great. I just wish that my metabolism, you know, had not disappeared a few years ago, because that food is probably the greatest joy, right? You know, for so many reasons.
No question. Mm-hmm. No question. Curtis, I got to tell you, it was fantastic. You're engaging. The story is amazing. Congratulations on all of your success. Obviously, you've got a lot of energy, and I'm sure you're going to continue to do great things.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you. Congratulations on the success of your podcast, too.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. Appreciate having you.